Great. May it please the court, Thomas Kimmel, registration number 9043, here today on appeal of a summary judgment order by the Weld County District Court. I represent the defendant, Robert McCormick, who is also present at council's table today. This case concerns a 160-acre ranch located in Grover, Colorado. In 2006, and continuing through January of 2010, Mr. McCormick entered into a series of contracts whereby he, which I'd call installment land contracts, whereby he agreed to reside and ultimately to have the option to purchase his 160-acre ranch. He continued in possession for 6 years. And in 2012, upon entry of the summary judgment order, he then departed from the property and left not only the property, but the buffalo herd that he had been cultivating. In 2008, a few years after he first took occupancy of the property, the parties also entered into a series of contracts relating to buffalo. And what happened is that Mr. McCormick agreed to take buffalo that were owned by the plaintiff, Mr. Trostel, to feed them, and then to, either through a sale or through a purchase price, pay a certain price for the buffalo. So that's generally the facts of this case.
Were the buffalo at all times relevant grazing on the ranch?
No, it wasn't until 2008 that the parties entered into their first contract relating to buffalo. The first few contracts between the parties, those in 2006 and 2007, just dealt with the real property.
My question is a little different. Okay. Let's say, as of January 2010, when the contract before us closed, were the buffalo grazing on the ranch?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
They were, and sorry not to answer your question directly. Since you're considering a summary judgment order, the review is de novo, there's no deference you need to pay to the trial court, and you have the same materials before you that the trial court did in deciding on summary judgment.
Let me ask you a procedural question, just before you get started on the substance, that probably does not bear on the ruling here, but I noticed that in the agreement it has a mandatory arbitration clause. Did the parties just waive that and decide to go to court instead?
Yes. Essentially, neither party asked for arbitration, so there was no motion to compel.
Thank you.
Okay. The principal error that the court committed in this case concerns its failure to apply the law relating to divisible contracts. What a divisible contract is, as defined by common law contract principles, is a contract where items are covered by the contract are divided into more than two parts, two or more parts, and the performance has separate provisions of each item, both in terms of one party's performance and the other party's performance of that item is in turn tied into the corresponding part of the other party's performance. That may be a long way to say it, but essentially, under those circumstances, if the contract deals with two items separately and has different performance obligations and exchanges, then the contract is considered essentially to be two contracts. The breach of one item of the contract is separate and apart from the other. And under that analysis, the court is supposed to look at each item to see whether they were properly breached, that each stand on their own.
Is it your position that the obligations in this contract are severable as a matter of law, or simply that the contract is unclear on severability, making summary judgment inappropriate and requiring a factual determination of the party's underlying intent?
Well, I understand that you might decide that there's a genuine issue of material fact, so how to interpret this, and it's ambiguous. In my opinion, as a matter of law, you can read that contract, and this is the perfect classic example as a matter of law of what a divisible contract is. Paragraphs 1 and 2 separately deal with the bison and the real property purchase. Probably what's most telling, if you look at paragraphs 4, is that it's possible for Mr. McCormick under this contract to purchase the bison. The contract says he tenders $25,000, he gets a bill of sale. The contract also says, separate and apart from that bison purchase, and by the way, that contract is Exhibit D in the record. The provision also goes on to say that if Mr. McCormick wants to purchase the real property, it's a whole different procedure. He pays the remaining portion of $125,000, and then he gets a warranty deed. So this is a case where it's hard to imagine a better example of a contract that deals with items of performance in two different ways and schedules each performance in response to the corresponding part of the contract rather than considering them both as a whole.
Was there a promissory note for the payment of the ranch or only a note for the payment of the buffalo?
No promissory note. Title did not pass at the time of the execution of the contract in terms of any deed. The way this contract was worded was that there was a $5,000 option payment, which Mr. McCormick made, and then he made $750 monthly payments toward the property. And in terms of the bison, there was a separate $500 monthly payment.
Mr. Kimmel, if the contract is divisible, as you maintain, what is your explanation of the language in paragraph 5 relied on by opposing counsel that refers to in the event of any default?
My interpretation is that provision, first of all, whenever forfeiture or termination of a contract is involved, there is the rule that forfeiture is abhorred. So there's a construction of a contract where you try to make it valid rather than providing for termination. I think that clause only means that each item, you have to follow that procedure separately. So in part because Mr. McCormick was in possession of the property, the parties agreed that before anything could be terminated, there had to be notice and a reasonable opportunity to cure. So what I contend is that in order for Mr. Trussell to have terminated this contract, he would have had to comply with paragraph 5 as to both items. In other words, he would have had to give notice saying, you're in default of the Buffalo contract, and you need to pay this amount of money to cure that. As to the real property purchase part, first of all, it wasn't in default. The evidence is genuinely in dispute on that one. But what should have happened was, there should have been separate notice given that the real property component was in default and a cure period or a cure right be given as to what amount of money would need to be paid in order to cure that property default. What happened in this case was that the only default letter, which is a February 3 letter from Mr. Trussell, mentioned only the bison purchase and said nothing about any default as to the real property. So Mr. McCormick was in. So essentially what Mr. Trussell had to do is sidestep the real property issue entirely, declare a breach of the divisible part of the contract dealing with bison, and then say the whole thing's terminated. Well, I think the best interpretation, the only reasonable interpretation, is that the contract is divisible, the breach of one doesn't cause a breach of the other.
What is your view on the state of Colorado law on divisibility of contracts? I noticed that there weren't any cases cited in either of the briefs, quite frankly. Is this a matter of first impression, or is there some authority out there that guides us on this issue?
Well, I agree with you, Your Honor, that I didn't find any Colorado case directly dealing with this divisible contract issue, but it's common law contract. There's no reason to believe that Colorado would follow a rule different from any other rule. I gave quotes from commentators, which made no exception for Colorado. And it's really similar to another rule in Colorado, contract rule, which is, that's the rule of what breach of a contract is sufficiently material to to cause its termination. And Colorado contract law says not every breach is terminable. It's just breaches that go to the heart of the contract. So under that same analysis, the breach of the bison purchase does not go to the any breach of the real property portion of the contract. Now, the trial court didn't really deal with this issue at all. The court did say, I'm not going to really deal with this issue of divisibility, but I will say that McCormick breached both obligations. Well, that analysis is defective for two reasons. Number one, there's no facts to support it. We've put into evidence Mr. McCormick's testimony that he was not in default on the real property. And if you look at a chart that's Exhibit I that Mr. Trostel prepared, that shows that every payment on the real property from March through August was paid. And thus the trial court erred because the trial court said there was no payment made between March and August, but there was evidence before the court showing at least a genuine issue of material fact that the trial court ignored. The second part of the court's, another major error that the court committed was its failure to require Mr. Trostel to comply with the terms of the notice and reasonable opportunity to cure. That same default letter, February 3, says that $25,000 is the cure amount, and that's the default. But Mr. Trostel's own chart shows that there were about $8,000 of payments made by Mr. McCormick toward the bison and another $6,000 to $8,000 made toward the real property purchase. So what Mr. Trostel was obligated to do was not to say you owe $25,000, we're not going to give you credit for any payments, but to allow the cure to be exercised at the proper rate. And both Mr. Trostel and the Weld County Court confused the contract here. If you look at that same contract, the January 24 contract, what it says is that, and it's this is paragraph 5, the default procedure, that if you don't cure a default, then the seller can retain past payments as liquidated damages. So in other words, if Mr. McCormick fails to cure the default, default is properly given for the right number, let's say 18,000. He fails to cure, then the seller can keep his past payments as liquidated damages. But that's a post opportunity to cure procedure. And in the first instance, he has the right to cure, so he had to be given credit for the payments he had made for the entire year of 2010, with Mr. Trostel entirely failed to give him any credit.
What language in paragraph 5 do you rely on to obligate Mr. Trostel to state the amount necessary to effect a cure, as opposed just to giving a blanket notice that says this obligation is due, it's in default, you've got however many days to cure it, period?
Well, in this case, if that's all he had done, it might have given Mr. McCormick the ability to cure based on what he thought was owing, based on his records. But in this case, Mr. Trostel said, the only way you can cure is to pay me $25,000. That was his letter of February 3, 2011. So Mr. McCormick was in no position to cure by paying a number different from the number that Mr. Trostel had indicated. And
why is that so? Why can't, if the parties dispute the amount needed to cure, why can't Mr. McCormick tender what he thinks is the correct amount, maybe pad it with a little extra, and then say, if you don't agree, we'll go to court and litigate the propriety of the cure?
That's exactly what he did.
Well, then why is it a separate issue that Mr. Trostel didn't comply with paragraph 5 because he didn't give a cure amount?
Well, just to clarify, what Mr. McCormick did is, when the lawsuit was filed, he and thereafter he continued to make the monthly payments. And indeed, you'll see in the file, we actually filed a motion with the court to allow a registry of the court to receive the payments, and the court declined to receive those. So we tried to preserve our rights to claim that in the event that the cure amount was wrong, that we had the right to still remain in possession, but we were denied that right by the trial court.
But isn't the issue to be litigated then whether the correct cure amount was tendered, not whether Mr. Trostel mistakenly or otherwise provided a wrong amount?
I still submit, Your Honor, that it's reasonable to imply from a notice and opportunity to cure that some figure is given here.
But that's an implication. You're not relying on specific language.
I agree. There's no specific language saying that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kimmel.
May it please the court. My name is Eve Canfield. Registration number 34151. I am here representing Mr. Thomas Trostel, who is also present. And I wanted to clarify with the court the standard of review for granting granting of summary judgment is de novo. However, the findings of fact of a trial court are not to be set aside unless clearly erroneous.
Let me ask you about that, because you say that in your answer brief. And you also say in the answer brief that the we're supposed to presume that the prevailing party, all the presumptions are in favor of the prevailing party. Isn't it just the opposite in a summary judgment motion? And the court on summary judgment doesn't make findings of fact, does it? I mean,
well.
Yeah, the facts are undisputed, presumably, for purposes of summary judgment.
Well, Your Honor, the way it was worded in the district court's ruling made, these are the undisputed facts of this case, and then listed several undisputed facts.
But don't we then have a de novo obligation to determine whether they are, in the record, whether there are disputed facts or not?
Yes, Your Honor.
So we don't defer to the trial court then?
Well, in Ray v. Estate of Hain, as I stated in my brief, it indicates that those facts are not to be set aside unless clearly erroneous.
Is Hain a summary judgment case?
Your Honor, I would have to check. Your Honor, the issues here are really based upon two provisions of the contract as I see it. There's the default provision in the contract, and there's the merger provision of the contract. There are the separate covenants argument made by Mr. McCormick rely upon parole evidence. In his argument, he's stating, well, because we had a contract for bison earlier, and because we had a lease for land, that somehow this 2010 agreement between the parties is divisible. Well, they were Mr. McCormick was purchasing land, and he was purchasing bison. It was one contract. The monthly payments were one monthly payment. It was divided between first to interest, second to land, and third to bison. Very early in his performance, Mr. McCormick's performance in this contract, he was late in his payments. And under the terms of the contract, then Mr. Trostel could change the interest rate from 6 to 12. Essentially, after March 2010, the interest rate made the payment barely covering the interest on the total value of the contract. The payments were not divisible. There weren't separate payments for land and separate payments for checks. Bison. One check was made. The separate covenants, nothing was cited in Colorado law. He didn't argue in terms of materiality. The cases he did cite, as I recall, are issues of materiality, whether a 15-acre parcel is can be sold when it's really 15.1 acres. The separate covenants issue, the failure to provide proper notice, Mr. Trostel provide proper notice. He said, this is what you owe. Essentially, there was no equity buildup on the property because the payments at 12% barely covered the interest. And he relies on parole evidence to get to this divisibility argument.
Doesn't he also rely on the plain language of the agreement?
Well, the fact that there's a price for the bison and the price for the land, that's true. But there's one default provision. And the default provision says, if you make a late payment, more than 30 days, it doesn't say on land, doesn't say on bison, doesn't say on interest. It says, if you make a late payment more than 30 days, then Mr. Trostel has to provide a notice to cure. Mr. Trostel provided a notice to cure 30 plus days after the failure to make the lump sum payment on the bison.
But why isn't the agreement essentially in conflict? That we've got your interpretation of paragraph 5, which is a, you know, essentially an umbrella default cure provision. We've got other provisions of the contract that address the bison and the property in separate paragraphs, allocate the purchase price separately, and what's most important to me is they would allow Mr. McCormick to take title to the bison within a year, even though at this payment schedule it's going to take him a very, very long time to ever pay off the ranch.
Well, that
doesn't that suggest divisibility, that he can get the bison in a year and he's going to spend the next 10, 12 years on that payment schedule paying off the ranch?
Well, he would be doing that based upon a 12% interest rate because of his failure to make payments when due. It doesn't make the contract itself divisible in terms of the default provision for failure to pay for over 30 days on a payment.
Ms. Canfield, Mr. Kimmel said that there was no Colorado law on divisible contracts. Number one, do you agree with that? And number two, what is your view as to whether or not in Colorado there can be a divisible contract?
I think there, Your Honor, I didn't find any case law in terms of divisibility. What I did find, which may relate, is more in the way of a UCC contract in the selling of products that you could divide. You could say, okay, I'm buying 100 of these widgets and 100 of these widgets. I've performed on this, but I haven't provided this. It wasn't exactly on point with taking a contract that is one contract and somehow make divisible your obligations to pay.
So do you have a view as to whether or not in Colorado, other than in the UCC context, in this context specifically, whether at least theoretically there could be a divisible contract? And I recognize, of course, your position is that it's not here, but theoretically, could there be a divisible contract in your view?
I didn't find any case law. I didn't find any circumstances that really address this particular point in terms of taking one contract and saying, okay, I had a major breach of this agreement, but it's only because, you know, I did it on this side, I didn't do it on this side, and therefore the contract as a whole isn't in default, that the party hasn't breached.
Do you agree with your opponent that there was no promissory note representing the balance owed on the ranch?
That's correct, ranch or bison.
There's a promissory note on the bison, isn't there?
No, there's only this contract. There's no notes.
The demand letter of February 3, 2011 says the note signed by you for purchase of the bison dated such and such in the amount of $25,000. So doesn't that refer to a promissory note?
There is no promissory note. Mr. Castle was referring to this agreement for bison and land.
So his reference to a note is just a mistake?
I believe so, Your Honor.
And this continuing on that February 3rd, what everybody is calling the default letter, where in there does he say what the, he just says it's in arrears. Is there any indication in this or any other evidence in the record of what the arrears was? How's he supposed to cure if he doesn't know what the arrears is?
Well, I believe Mr. Trussell indicated $25,000.
Oh, it just says that the note was for $25,000.
Your Honor, the payment of $25,000 was due January 1st. That's what he was referring to. The obligation in the contract to pay $25,000 January 1st.
So is it your contention that the full $25,000 was owed, that he'd not made any payments during this entire time?
That's correct. Due to the fact that he was behind on his payments as of March 2010, and the increased rate of 12% was applied, and, you know, interest, then land, then bison. There was nothing left to pay towards the bison.
Did Mr. Trostel ever give Mr. McCormick notice that he was accelerating the interest rate from 6 to 12%?
Not that I have on the record, Your Honor.
Thank you.
And to clarify this, the property is acreage. There is no residence located on the property. The contract provision regarding merger and parole evidence excludes the information, excludes the argument of a prior agreements that would somehow create the divisibility of the current, the 2010 contract that was in effect. The undisputed facts were that Mr. Trostel had paid only 9 out of 12 payments as of the time that Mr. Trostel gave him notice that he had breached the agreement in terms of the $25,000 payment. The list of payments referred to showed payments with checks that were not good, that were returned for insufficient funds, checks that were missed completely. The money that was either deposited into Mr. Trostel's account after the termination, Mr. Trostel returned those funds. Those copies of those checks were included after the termination of the contract. So there were funds paid to Mr. Trostel, but they were returned to him. And as far as the amount due for the bison, Mr. McCormick never indicated he disputed the amount that was stated in the notice to cure. And in fact, no communication at all after the notice to cure. And Mr. Trostel gave him not 15 days as allowed by the contract, he in fact gave him 30 days to.
Where does it say?
In the record following the notice of the initial cure, February 3rd, Mr. Trostel waited till March 3rd, and it's in the facts in my answer brief. He sent the notice that the contract was terminated 30 days later, not 15.
But that letter doesn't say that he has 15 days or 30 days to cure.
Well, for the contract, he has 15 days to cure. Mr. McCormick's an attorney. He helped draft this contract, so he should have been fully aware of his rights under the default provision to cure within 15 days. Mr. Trostel gave him 30.
Once the summary judgment was filed, did Mr. McCormick put information into the record disputing that he was in default on the ranch?
Did Mr. I don't believe so. He issued a letter that said that he, in July, he promised, he said he would pay whatever was required because he didn't make the January payment. So he admitted he was in default in terms of the $25,000 license payment.
And I apologize if my question was unclear.
I'm sorry.
In the summary judgment record, did Mr. McCormick put in an affidavit, deposition testimony, or something else disputing that he was in default as to the ranch, not as to the bison?
I believe he did.
So that's for purposes of a summary judgment review, then there is a disputed issue of fact as to whether there he was in default on the ranch.
Well, he argued that he was not in default on the ranch based on the divisibility argument.
I'm not asking you to concede divisibility. I'm just asking you to concede that there is a disputed issue of fact in the record as to whether Mr. McCormick was in default as to the ranch as opposed to the bison.
Well, the evidence was provided, copies of checks, copies of deposits, a complete listing of every payment made. So, yes, he did dispute that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Canfield. Thank you again, Mr. Kimmel. We appreciate both of your arguments this morning. The case will stand submitted and a written opinion will issue in due course. That